Nature is my manifestation of God. I go to nature every day for inspiration in the day's work. I follow in building the principles which nature has used in its domain. No house should ever be on a hill or on anything. It should be of the hill, belonging to it. Hill and house should live together, each the happier for the other. Those are the comments of Frank Lloyd Wright. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In 1991, the American Institute of Architects called Frank Lloyd Wright the greatest American architect of all time, a pioneer in creating a style of organic architecture. He was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin in 1967, and before his death in 1959 would create designs for more than 1,000 structures. Scandals and tragedies in his personal life would sometimes overshadow his accomplishments as an artist. His Spring Green residence, Taliesin, celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. What makes Frank Lloyd Wright such a continuing presence? Joining us to discuss Frank Lloyd Wright is Ronald McRae, prize-winning journalist and the author of Building Taliesin, A Tale of Love and Loss, published in 2012 by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Was it Frank Lloyd Wright who said that architecture is frozen music? Is that where that description came from?
He would claim to have originated yeah. that, although I think many others did as well. I always liked jazz man Ben Sidran's reply to that, which is that music is thought architecture.
Well, in either case, occasionally when I think of Frank Lloyd Wright, I think also of Wagner as being one of these big controversial figures who really changed the direction of the art in which he was involved and how things were never quite the same afterward. Does that sound accurate in terms of describing the continuing appeal?
It certainly does, and it also is true that, as I learned when I was studying Wagner in college, he said this was every year brides go down the aisle to music written by probably the greatest home wrecker of his, of his age.
Yeah, right.
But Wagner's music, and if you discover it after coming from the early forms of opera and then you hit Wagner, it is like nothing else. And it is such a strange and different sound when you come up to it from this, from the Baroque opera and other things. And I think that is true for people when they encounter a Frank Lloyd Wright building. You can go driving down a street and then suddenly there is the shock of Frank Lloyd Wright, and it's mm-hmm. always something different. I mean, you really can see, even in on buildings that are more than 100 years old, as we have some up in Prospect Street in Madison, there are buildings that are actually younger than the Airplane House, the Gilmore House on the hill and on the top of the building, which is a very sleek, low-slung prairie house. But it looks really much more modern than its time, and it looks like it could have been built yesterday. And that's the kind of one of the effects that you see from Wright, is that suddenly there's something new under the sun.
And how do we explain sort of the creation of Frank Lloyd Wright and his vision of architecture? If you look all the way back to his beginnings in Richland Center and his upbringing, his particular set of parents, what led up to his way of looking at buildings in such a profoundly original way?
You know, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that as a journalist. I've read a lot about Frank Lloyd Wright, and I've visited a lot of his buildings and looked at a lot of them. I think that he had one of the important things in the formation of Wright's visual talents was his training with the Froebel School of kindergarten. His mother gave him the Froebel gifts, which were blocks and strips of colored paper and strings and other kinds of things. And he really got a sense of how to work with geometry from the Froebel training system, which was also used for a number of other well-known artists and architects of the period. So he had the benefit of kind of early progressive education, for one thing, which brought this out. He had a wonderful visual sense. He also had was raised around music because his father, William Carey Wright, was both an organist and pianist and a composer. He was a preacher by trade. But he composed music, and I think that although Wright gives a lot of credit to his mother for his formation, his father really probably gave him a lot of his musical background.
But didn't his father take off? Isn't that why Frank Lloyd Wright switched from Frank Lincoln Wright to Frank Lloyd Wright?
Well, Frank, his father didn't take off. He was pushed out by his mother, really literally expelled from the house. She'd had enough of him. And she also expelled his children by his first marriage, and so that it was just her and Frank and the sisters. And it's true that he really never had any contact with his father again, but it's also true that after his mother died, he didn't attend her funeral. But he did create her into quite a large legend in his autobiography.
So he is a creator in more senses than just building houses.
Yes, he is he's a fabulist in many ways. He is he's a storyteller, and one of the largest stories he tells is about himself. And many of the legends are true, including, for example, the legend of the windmill, the famous windmill that his aunts had him build in the late 19th century, which he called Romeo and Juliet. And, of course, this is, once again, one of the things you see in just this example is how he had a way of giving a kind of a literary or storytelling quality to his architecture that could appeal to people. So he built this tower for a windmill on this farm, and it had a balcony, and he was thinking that it would look like Romeo and Juliet's balcony. And his uncle said that it would never stand and that it would fall over. It was a experimental design, but his aunts had faith in him, and it did stand. It outlived all of them and is still there today.
And Taliesin?
Taliesin has, let's go back to Frank Lloyd Wright. He had spent his teenage summers in the valley in near Spring Green, even though he grew up in Madison, spent his teenage years here in Madison. But he had spent summers on the farm, partly because his mother thought he needed to be toughened up a little bit. And he didn't like the farm work, but he loved the nature of the valley. And that's when he really got a sense of the valley and his connection to nature, which was the other huge influence in the way that his architecture is rolled out and was developed. But he spent time there, and that was a Welsh community, and the word Taliesin literally means shining brow or radiant brow in the Welsh language. And it's also a pun in a way, because when he was creating the concept for Taliesin, he wanted it to look like an outcropping of rock on the side of a hill, that it would be a feature in nature that looked like nature. They would almost be camouflaged. No one, however, called it Taliesin for years and years. It was called the bungalow, or worse, the love bungalow.
Yes, we'll get to that later.
Like that. But a lot of this came from his Welsh roots, and I might also say that the Welsh side of his family, of course, is very musical as well, and there's a huge musical tradition in Wales.
Yes.
Some of the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings that I've been in, my husband, who's 6'6", has to bend his head because the ceilings are often lower than that, and then contrasted with very, very high ceilings elsewhere in the design. Was Frank Lloyd Wright himself a short man?
He was, and I myself am a 6'5", and I have to bend over and pay homage to Frank Lloyd Wright.
Maybe that was intentional. I never thought of it that way.
I think there is, what is a lot of architectural critics have observed, that on the one hand, he did think that his height was the ideal human size, and he was constantly telling his tall apprentice, William Wesley Peters, to sit down because he was destroying the scale of the room. But at the same time, Wright had one of Wright's great features in his architecture, and you can see it in a lot of buildings, and you can see it in Madison and Monona Terrace and other places, is the feature where he'll have you come in through a kind of low entrance, and maybe not even a front entrance. It'll be a side entrance, or it'll wind its way around, and then all of a sudden there will be a big surprise, and the room will open up and soar up. And so you see this in lots of places. You certainly see it when you go into the Unity Chapel, Temple in Oak Park, and other places.
And the Unitarian Church here in Madison as well.
Yes, indeed. You come in through a low hallway, and then suddenly you have this soaring space. And it's a wonderful architectural soaring spirit moment that he likes to repeat again and again. And of course, it is also especially true in the living room of Taliesin, where you'll come in and duck through corridors and low walkways and then walk into this wonderful room which has high ceilings and a wonderful view of the of the hills and valley beyond.
Well, you know, it's one thing to be able to come up with these fantastic designs, but as a young starting architect, Frank Lloyd Wright had to somehow sell people on his concepts, didn't he? Or how did he become this different architect?
Well, he worked and went to work for Louis Sullivan, for one thing. He went to Chicago after studying a bit of engineering at the University of Wisconsin and worked for a prairie style company name that was run by a man named Silsby. And then he joined the studio of Louis Sullivan, who was doing these wonderful, authentic buildings that they were really what he really wanted to try to do was to create an authentic style of American architecture that did not borrow from European styles, that was not historical, it was not classical, it didn't look like ancient Rome, it didn't look like ancient Greece, it didn't look like a German castle. It was something absolutely new and all American. And so that was what he was always trying to do, and that's why he went back again and again to the prairie, and why he had such little regard, really, for the East Coast and the East Coast intellectuals. He thought that the new ideas were coming out of the Midwest and the West.
What sort of American architecture was there before Wright? The only thing I can come up with is Steamboat Gothic, which I imagine he probably abhorred.
Well, I think that you had a lot of New England style, colonial style, which was also English style, and then you had the Romanesque revival and various kinds of revivals and Gothic revivals. But all of these came from other cultures and other times. And so he really wanted to do something that was not only American, but also honest. And honesty in architecture was a large theme of his work, that he wanted to have materials speak for themselves. He did not like decoration. He did not like painting. He did not like doodads and gingerbread. He thought that the geometry of the building and the quality of the materials, and he wrote wonderful essays on the nature of materials, on glass, on wood, on steel, that these were beautiful in and of themselves. And this was, of course, a part of the arts and crafts movement, which started in Britain but also was very big in the United States. And he was a very big part of it until he wanted to separate himself out and make himself really the lone pioneer.
And what were his politics? Because there's something about his architecture that seems more populist, more of the people, I guess, and less pretentious than the prevailing style.
Well, he liked to call himself a democratic architect. I mean, when you saw the Taliesin Fellowship, it was definitely not a democracy that he was running out at Spring Green with the School of Architecture. But he liked to think of himself as an architecture for democracy, and part of that was creating homes that did not have a class structure in them, that did not have this, although some of his earlier mansions had servant quarters. A lot of the later ones, and the ones that made him very popular with the American public, were almost like ranch homes and what we would now call ranch homes, but they were more simple homes that did not have basements, did not have attics, did not have that had an open plan, so there were the family members were not shut out from each other. There was a more equality in the place, and he really also didn't want a lot of work for the woman of the house. Now a lot of women clients who took him on asked for more space, asked for more kitchen space, asked for more storage space, and they had to fight him very hard to get it because he wanted the home to be kind of a very simple living machine.
Now, is there irony in his democracy as an architect in that how many people could actually afford a Frank Lloyd Wright house?
Well, it's true. The custom-designed Frank Lloyd Wright house always ran over budget, but of course here in Madison, he always really did have an interest in good architecture for everyone, good design for all, and that was part of the arts and crafts movement, but he really did want it, and he always was trying to create multiple family architecture, modular architecture, do-it-yourself kind of architecture, and in fact, the first so-called Usonian house in his works was created here in Madison as a response to a challenge from a newspaper reporter for the Capital Times of Madison who said, "Mr. Wright, I would like to see you build a home for a working man for $5,000, I think the price was at that time." And he responded, and he wound up being able to do it. Now, it took a lot of labor on the part of Herbert Jacobs and his family, and write, I think, probably contributed some materials from other building sites to help him with the budget. But he wound up doing that, and a lot of people, the idea caught fire. It's true that he was not able to do a mass-produced housing module in his lifetime, but I think that he set the course for a lot of things. And that's one of the things that is true about skepticism about Wright on a number of things, that we'll say, well, his roof's leaked and his windows cracked. But he was always trying to push materials ahead of themselves, and he wanted to see the possibility in materials that hadn't been used yet, whether it was the homely concrete block or glass tubing in the ceilings of Johnson Wax. He wanted to see with their possibilities of less expensive materials, but they didn't require a lot of decoration or handcrafting.
Was his decision to even get involved in the creation of furniture, was that because he was tired of having his buildings messed up by other people's taste?
Oh, probably. He also thought that the architecture was the mother art, and all the others were subsidiary. And he didn't like to really have many paintings, except for Japanese prints, which he admired a great deal, on his walls. And he knew his limitations as a furniture builder, and said that he had more bruises from sitting in his own chairs than practically anything else, and that he really did like reclining better than sitting. And he built in a lot of his best furniture actually is built-in furniture. And that was true for a lot of his homes. One of the features I think he liked about built-in furniture was that the owners couldn't move it around.
Well, sure, it wouldn't interfere with
his architectural design. But there was also a thing that I think he learned while he was in Europe, and it was very popular with the German and other European architects, which was to create what they called a Gesamtkunstwerk, which meant a total work of art, which means that you not only created the building and decided the site, but you created every room, you created all the furniture, you created the china, the silverware, the, you know, really even perhaps the gowns worn by the woman of the house. He did some of all of those. And so you'll see in places, and he did quite a bit of this around the time that he built Taliesin. When he built the Midway Gardens concert and dining complex on the south side of Chicago, which took up a huge full block, he designed everything, including the chairs and the tables and the furniture and the china, all of it, to his taste. And the same for the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, which he did shortly after that. And so even now you can go to Tiffany and other places and see reproductions of some of his best decorative designs. But this was all part of being the total controlling designer of every aspect of this work of art.
We'll find out where Frank Lloyd Wright really started to take off as a celebrity architect when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
That's from Hymn to Nature, a chorus from the opera Shining Brow by Darren Hagen about famous 20th century American architect Frank Lloyd Wright. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Ron McCrae, and we are talking about Frank Lloyd Wright. Your book entitled Building Taliesin, Home of Love and Loss. Tell us about the love and loss and the creation of Taliesin and where that fit in his life.
Well, Taliesin was created as an architectural solution to a terrible personal problem that Wright was having at the time. The problem was that he had fallen in love with a woman named Mamie Borthwick Cheney, who was the wife of a client of his, and actually was a client of his in Oak Park. He'd been married for some time to a woman named Catherine, and they had six children. But he, in his 40s and in her 40s, both of these people found each other and finally kind of both felt that their marriages had hit a wall and that they needed refreshment with each other and a new creative collaboration. And so basically, they both asked for divorces. And her husband agreed to a divorce, but Wright's wife, Catherine, would not. And so even after a year's kind of waiting and trying out, the answer was still no. And so he took off for Europe with her in the fall of 1909. To spend a year together in what was sort of a trial marriage. And they found themselves, after briefly being exposed in Berlin when a newspaper reporter from the Chicago Tribune saw their name on the register of a very exclusive celebrity hotel that had just opened, the Hotel Adlon near the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. They divided and then reunited on a hillside overlooking Florence, Italy, in the spring of 1910. And this is really where, after spending a really blissful summer together that he writes about in his autobiography, he decides that he has to have they have to have a solution for reentering the United States. Let me read you a bit of what he wrote to a friend, Charles Ashby in England, about his time there in Italy. He says, "I have been very busy here in this little eyrie on the brow of the mountain above Fiesole, overlooking the pink and white Florence, spreading in the valley of the Arno below, the whole fertile bosom of the earth seemingly lying in the drifting mists, or shining clear and marvelous in this Italian sunshine, opalescent, iridescent." And what's interesting about this description, in part, is that he uses the word brow to describe his situation on the hill overlooking Florence, Italy. Fiesole is a little town above Florence, in the suburbs of Florence, a very old Etruscan and Roman city. And Wright found this wonderful little villa for himself and Mamie on the hillside with a garden outside of it. And they really got into the experience of living the Italian style with the outdoors and indoors communicating with each other, and this wonderful experience of being on a hillside overlooking a river valley. And this gave him the inspiration, and I think probably in his mind's eye, he always remembered sights, that there was another river valley and another hillside that he knew very well, and this was in Wisconsin, and that this would be a way for them to come back and be away from prying eyes of Chicago, be away from their families, allow things to settle down and themselves to get regularized if possible. But this was the necessity that prompted Wright to write his mother on the 4th of July, 1910, from Italy, saying that he could not come back to Oak Park. They were not going to do that because she would be treated like a prostitute and he would be treated by a weakling and they would both be the objects of scorn. And he says the basis of this whole struggle was the desire for a fuller measure of life and truth at any cost. And so he says the solution is that he has a piece of land in mind next to that owned by his sister Jane and Andrew Porter in the valley of his Welsh ancestors. And he says, "I would like to farm it beside him with that tract of Ryder's and Uncle Thomas's farm joined together." And this, written on the 4th of July, 1910, is really his Declaration of Independence. I mean, I think that Taliesin was, in many ways, Wright's Declaration of Independence. It was his independence from the mores of polite society, his independence from urban life and the prying eyes of the city. his independence actually from the architectural profession as it was then being practiced, because he was able to set himself up as the lone heroic architect in the countryside, although he kept an office in Chicago. And so it was his declaration of independence in practically every way. And Taliesin was actually created to be self-sufficient as far as it could be. He wanted it to be a self-contained world, and he wanted it to be a working farm and a working studio and a home and all of the above, and an inspiration for others. And so,
kind of utopian then.
It was utopian. It was, of course, it was also kind of aristocratic in its own way too, because he'd seen it in Italy. He wanted to live like a rural Italian baron in a way, but with a full functioning farm and self-sufficiency, and he wanted to be independent. And so I think there is still that, even though he had a great feel for writing for democracy and talked a good line about democracy, in many ways he was a 19th century individualist.
And in what ways does he figuratively and literally break new ground at Taliesin?
First, interestingly, it all happened in secret over a year's time. It does look like, to me, as going over the evidence, that they had a one-year plan, that they would come back to the United States and pretend that they had broken up with one another. He would go back to Oak Park and try to collect his business, quietly divide his home and studio into a home and rental property for his wife so she would have income, then have his mother sign the deed for the land in Wisconsin so that he would not be identified as the purchaser, and also his wife couldn't get her hands on it. And so his mother actually owned the property for Taliesin, and he told his client Darwin Martin that he needed $10,000 to build this place as a cottage for his mother, a little cottage upcountry. Was
how $10,000 was a lot of money 100 years ago.
It certainly was. It was about $260,000 as I did a calculation once. And it was about, of course, if you look at Taliesin now, which has 600 acres and a lot of associated buildings, Taliesin the first was about half the size of the original house and half the property. But it was quite beautiful, and I was able to find some wonderful photographs of this place that had been basically unseen for 80 or 90 years.
And did his plan of sort of fooling the public work?
Well, it worked until he was able to quietly build the place in the spring, summer, and fall of 1911. And then Mamo, meanwhile, stayed in Europe and did not return until June of 1911. Went to Canada and met with her children, got her divorce finalized in August, and then only then showed up at Taliesin. So she was now divorced, and she had taken her maiden name, and so she was free and independent. He was not, and they made it work until Christmas of 1911, at which point something happened. I think that probably the rental sign went up at his house and for the rental property. And so the Chicago Tribune challenged him about it, and he said, yes, indeed, we are together, and there is no Mrs. Cheney, there has never been one in my mind, but Mamo Borthwick is here, and I am taking care of her. And with that, the nuts were off the buggy, and the Chicago press came and camped out for a week, and there was this huge scandal for about 10 days, and it finally blew over because the sheriff of Iowa County was not going to arrest them, and the people locally were not going to tar and feather them. They made up all these stories to suggest that this would be the case. The local Lloyd Joneses, who were very proud and pious people, did not approve, but they did not take any action, even though there were reports that there was going to be a family council with them sitting in judgment. But in fact, his mother held the key to all of it because she had the deed. She could have evicted them, but she did not do anything. And so I think she always had his back. His boy's best friend was his mother when it came to Frank Lloyd Wright. And if you're interested, I mean, there were two things that surfaced to tell us about this process in the last few years. One was a set of letters that was discovered in Sweden that Mamo Borthwick had written to her mentor, Ellen Kay, whose work she was translating from Swedish and German. They were works about women's rights and feminism. And then the other thing was the discovery of these photographs, which I'll go into in a little bit. But Mema wrote to shortly after she got to Taliesin, and she left a description of it in one of her letters. And she wrote to Ellen Kay in Sweden, "I have, as you hoped, made a choice in harmony with my own soul. The choice, as far as my own life was concerned, was made long ago. That is absolute separation from Mr. Cheney. A divorce was obtained last summer, and my maiden name is now legally mine. Also, I have since made a choice in harmony with my own soul and what I believe to be Frank Wright's happiness, and am now keeping his house for him. In this very beautiful hillside, as beautiful in its way as the country about Strand," which is the name of Ellen Kay's own home on a lake in Sweden, "he has been building a summer house, Taliesin, the combination of site and dwelling, quite the most beautiful I have seen any place in the world. We are hoping to have some photographs to send you soon. I believe it is a house founded on Ellen Kay's ideal of love. The nearest neighbor, half a mile away, is Frank's sister, where I visited when I first came here. She has championed our love most loyally, believing it her brother's happiness. I have been thus far very busy with the unfinished house, and because of that fact, that workmen were boarded here in a nearby farmhouse, sometimes as many as 36 at a time. Mr. Wright's sister has looked after this all summer, but when I came it was turned over to me, and I have done very little of your translation work in consequence of the building. The house is now, however, practically finished, and my time again free. Mr. Wright has his studio incorporated into the house, and we both will be busy with our own work with absolutely no outside interests on my part. My children I hope to have at times, but that cannot be just yet." So this is really the first really vivid picture of life as lived by Frank and Mema at Taliesin when they first got together there. And how interesting to think of her coming from an existence as a woman from Oak Park, Illinois, who had servants in the home. There were about 9 people living in the home that she shared with Edwin Cheney and his mother-in-law and her sister and children and servants. And here she comes to this wilderness spot in Wisconsin and is handed over the job of feeding 3 dozen laborers on a construction site. She is at this point about 42 years old. And I think that they were both in their prime, and I guess they were game for it. But what a daunting challenge that must have been.
And how long did the idyllic work environment hold up at Taliesin?
Well, it really held up awfully well, except for that little speed bump of the scandal that broke out around Christmas 1911. They were soon able to resume their work. And she, in fact, by 1912, in the summer of 1912, had published, with Wright's help, 3 translations of Ellen Kay, and had a big book called The Woman Movement, underway to be translated and published by Putnam's in New York. So she was doing quite well with her translation. He predicted at the time that the scandal broke out that this would cost him a lot of architectural work with private homes because, he said, the architect really has to have the kind of trust of a family that the family physician does. And all of this scandal was going to cost him business, and it did. But 2 things replaced the business. One of them was commercial architecture. He did some schools buildings, and he also did the Midway Gardens in 1913. But big thing that happened in that first year was that he opened a second career as a dealer in Japanese art, and it was a huge career. Julia Meach, in her book on this aspect of Wright's life, says that there was a period of time where he actually made more money and had more business as an art dealer in Asian art than he did as an architect. And I think that was true, especially in 1912 into 1913. He was able to get a couple of brothers in Boston, the Spalding brothers, to bankroll him for a big trip to Japan. And so in January of 1913, 100 years ago this year, Mema and Frank took off and sailed for Japan and spent about 4 months there, with him voraciously looting the place for all of its best Japanese prints, many of which now, of course, reside in the Chazen Museum here in Madison.
I suppose he must have liked the emphasis on nature and the simplicity of the Japanese designs.
Well, one of the things that Wright did in 1912, talk about their creative production, they really hit the ground running when they got together. He published a book in Chicago called The Japanese Print and Interpretation in the summer of 1912. And many people feel this book and the essay in this book is the best theoretical description Wright ever gives of his artistic philosophy. And basically he believes that the Japanese printmakers had a special gift for seeing the underlying geometry of art and geometry of things. And he puts some sketches into the book to demonstrate this. That he really thinks that there is an underlying structure and geometry that is in the Japanese print and that is in nature as well. He's always looking for he's kind of a Neoplatonist, I guess, looking for the structure beneath the structure. And he saw that in Japanese art. But one of the things that's cool about his career as an art dealer is that unlike in architecture where he was being a solo practitioner and really out front of a lot of other people, you had to be a special type of client to take on a Wright project. When it came to dealing in Japanese art, he was absolutely in the center of the mainstream. He was a well-regarded prime dealer in Japanese art. And so he really, if he'd wanted to, could have continued to make a big career of this because, of course, the craze for all things Japanese was very strong in the period. But he respected Japanese art, and he really considered it the Japanese prints to be true, inspired, organic art.
And when did he do the hotel in Tokyo?
Well, while he was in Japan in 1913, he was able to get the contract to build the new hotel for Westerners in downtown Tokyo for the imperial household. And, in fact, one interesting little factoid is that the manager of the hotel actually had attended the University of Wisconsin, the Japanese manager. So he had a Badger State connection. But he returned with that in 1913, and one of his draftsmen named Emil Brodel, who had a wonderful gift for the kind of bird's eye view, drew a wonderful large rendering of the Imperial Hotel in 1913. That still exists, and I mentioned Brodel because he was one of the people who was murdered a year later at Taliesin.
And we're going to get into the murder.
Well, to finish that thought, he had the contract and he had the drawing made, and they were preparing in the summer of 1913. They were already looking forward to a life in Japan, and Mamo was writing to Ellen Kay saying, "Why don't you come with us?"
We're going to look at the murder that occurred at Taliesin and also some of the Frank Lloyd Wright tourism that's around us when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Ron McCrae, who's the author of the book Building Taliesin, and the subtitle of which has to do with some tragedy at that Frank Lloyd Wright retreat, I guess I'll call it, out toward Spring Green, Wisconsin. It seems to be more and more lately that the murder has come to light. It seemed for a long time that there really wasn't too much said about it.
Well, it was not. There was one of those things that, on the one hand, Wright wanted to forget about it. His family wanted to forget about it. His next wives wanted to forget about it. There was not a lot of the evidence was burned in the fire. There were not a lot of records of it. And actually, there was not the kind of malodorous journalism that was so interested in. They really were not at the time. There was not much reportage of this after the first spasm of this. But what happened was that in the summer of 1914, when everything looked wonderful, Wright had just had the grand opening of the Midway Gardens concert complex in Chicago. It was very popular. He had the contract going for Japan, and he had just done a big show of his work at the Art Institute of Chicago of everything that he had done from 1911 forward. everything. They really were on top of the world. And then in the middle of that summer, abruptly and absurdly and crazily, a servant at Taliesin snaps and douses the place with fire, with a gasoline, sets fires and attacks everyone there with a shingling hatchet, killing a total of 7 people within the space of an hour, almost all of them dying at once, a couple of them lingering for a couple of days before they died of wounds and burns, only 2 people surviving, and 3 children were victims in this fire and mass murder, and the residential wing of Taliesin was completely destroyed. Of course, in the newspaper business, we always say, don't say completely destroyed. It's destroyed, destroyed. It's completely destroyed.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway.
And it included Mema, right?
Yes. Well, it included Mema and her 2 children who had been in the habit of visiting every summer in mid-August. And this was the August 15th, 1914. Wright was away in Chicago on the grounds of the Midway Gardens doing some finishing touches, even though it had already had its official grand opening. The children were visiting because they did that every year, and it was the noon hour, and the chef, Julian Carlton, who was preparing to leave that day. He and his wife, Gertrude, were supposed to go back to Chicago. And Wright had already advertised for new help, but he seated them on a porch off the living room, the children and their mother, and then there were another 7 people at the other end, the workmen and draftsmen who were in another room at the other end of the building, and he attacked separately these 2 groups, because he had the elements of surprise and fire and accelerant and shingling hatchet, he was able to just do almost a commando-like raid, and it looked very, in retrospect, it looks very premeditated because it was very well thought out. And he even had a little bottle of hydrochloric acid in his pocket, which he proceeded to swallow when he was discovered hiding in the furnace, the cold furnace underneath the house. And he lingered so it was like a suicide.
Terrorist attack. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and he lingered for another 38 days. He died on October 8th.
And never explained any particular rational reason
really
for doing
didn't.
This.
There was a newspaper story saying that he said there was a reason I did this, and before I die, I'll say what it was. But they were making up everything in the Chicago papers those days. You can't trust any of it. Yeah. What is true about that whole episode, and is worth remembering by Wisconsinites, is that small town Wisconsin rose to its responsibilities in that case. This was a black man from Chicago who had committed horrible crimes. There was no question. There were witnesses who were able to attest to this, and yet he received due process. He received a court-appointed attorney by the sitting judge in Dodgeville. He had 2 court appearances, in fact, and the second one was carried in on a stretcher because he was so weak. But he did have due process, and he had the best medical attention that could be had at the time, which is still not very good if you have swallowed acid and burned your esophagus, and basically he starved to death. And so he actually received pretty decent treatment that you would not expect if you believe the stereotypes about small rural towns. This was small rural towns in progressive Wisconsin.
How long before Frank Lloyd Wright went back to Taliesin?
Oh, well, Wright was in Chicago, and he got a telephone call. There was phone service, and he got a phone call that there had been a fire, and he and his son John, who were working together at the time, took a train, and it had to be because it was a Saturday, probably a milk run that made a lot of small stops, and in all the stops along the way, he kept hearing more detail, and it sounded worse and worse. And Edwin Cheney, the father of the children and the divorced husband of Mema, was on the train as well. And by the time they got to Spring Green, the worst was known, and Wright's cousin, Richard Lloyd Jones, who was the editor then and owner of the Wisconsin State Journal, met their train and said, "Frank, it could not be worse. Get hold of yourself." And so he came there, and there was the actual scene is described in a poem by a woman named Edna Mudt, M-E-U-D-T, called A Summer Day That Changed the World, and I have reproduced it in my book, that which she witnessed as a little girl, and her father was the coachman who went to the station to bring Wright and Mr. Cheney back to the scene, and she describes it as an adult in a poem that is very documentary about how she climbed up, was brought up into the courtyard because people thought she might have been victimized. And she saw all the bodies lying there with sheets over them, and she described them as looking like statues at Lent, where they'd covered the statues in the Catholic Church.
And if we look at Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, the artist, what changed for him in his art after that?
You know, there have been a lot of theories that somehow this traumatic experience left him creating traumatic art or traumatized art, but I don't see it. I think that although some of his buildings shortly after that did have a kind of a fortress-like look, like the A.D. German warehouse in Richland Center, which looks like a Mayan pyramid. But for the most part, I think that Wright compartmentalized a lot of things. And his survival mechanism was remarkable because he kept moving on, picking up and moving on. He literally would not allow himself to look back. And he describes this in his autobiography as how he really couldn't see Mema anymore. She was absolutely gone from his life. And it was like that was the therapy that he had. He could not afford to think about it, so he would not. And actually, he wrote a letter in December of that year. He really had to decide what he was going to do with his life after this. And at the end of the letter, at the end of the year, he wrote to Ellen Kay in Sweden after she had written a letter of condolence. And I'd like to tell you what it is. He said that he really had a decision to make, whether basically give in to despair, or whether he could continue with his career. And so what he finally wrote to her was as follows: "Your kind words of Mema are like balm to my heart. There is nothing to say. The lightning struck us. Why, no one can say. All that remains is to keep it from sinking me so deep that my usefulness will be gone, or rather to take it as the heart of her would have me, and put the soul of her into the forms that take shape under my hands. We lived richly. She was taken suddenly, without warning or pain to her, I am sure, just as we were beginning to feel that the bitter struggle was giving way to that quiet assurance of peace and the place we coveted together. I hope that I can see you sometime. You have been a strength and comfort to us both, and we have blessed you often with love and regard. Faithfully yours, Frank Lloyd Wright." And so he says basically that he's decided to dedicate his work to her spirit. And so I think that he was able to compartmentalize her death and then move forward thinking of her in the best that he had to offer in architecture.
And he makes changes then when he rebuilds?
Well, at Taliesin, he makes change, he enlarges it, and he also reorients it a bit so that there's nothing really in the space where Mema and the children were killed. He did, however, put some pieces, some of the rocks that were burned by the fire into the mortar of the new building. And he rebuilt it right away. I mean, there's a story in December of 1914, the same year, that Talia in the Racine newspaper saying the Love Nest is basically rebuilt. It's good. It's larger than the older one, but it's going to be even more beautiful than the last. So the first statement he wanted to make was, "You can't burn me out, and I will rebuild. And this is my home, and it will remain that."
In the few minutes remaining that we have, tell us what you would recommend for those in Wisconsin, in particular, but perhaps anywhere, who want to get a good sense of what's out there with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, Wright, it is just amazing how Wright's popularity continues and his fascination. And I think it's because he lived so long and has reinvented himself so many different times in so many different ways, and that his personal story was as interesting as his buildings. If you fly into Dane County Regional Airport now, you're seeing a bunch of Frank Lloyd Wright effects right there. In Madison, this is a wonderful, we're coming into summer now, and it's a wonderful touring season in Madison, Monona Terrace, and also the Unitarian Meeting House. The Meeting House also has musicales through the summer months, and of course they have them during the winter. At Spring Green, there's a huge program of tours at Hillside at Taliesin. There's even an architectural day camp this year and a nice visitor center and bookstore. The Wyoming Valley School, which he designed at the very end is of his life, is now open as a cultural center with art exhibits in the area. In Milwaukee, there's a wonderful organization that has bought some so-called American system-built houses. This was one of Wright's first attempts at low-cost multiple housing, and they have been able to restore these places, and there are tours that are offered there regularly. There's a big annual event called Wright and Like. This year, it's a tourism and heritage event that includes not only Wright but other architects, and this year it's going to be in June in Lake Geneva and Lake Delavan. In Racine, and this exhibit will be up for a long time, the Johnson Wax Company has a wonderful exhibit in its gallery, the Johnson Gallery, called Usonia, this year, and going through a lot of periods of Wright's home designs and home design items, and you can see that there. And you can also visit Wingspread, which was the Herbert Johnson home Wright designed. And in Illinois, of course, if you go farther, there are a lot of things to see in Oak Park, his home and studio. And there's a big annual Wright Plus house walk. I'll be going there this year to sign books at the bookstore. You can rent places in Wisconsin. There are two homes. One is the Seth Peterson Cottage at Mirror Lake, and the other is the Bernard Schwartz House in Two Rivers. Very hard to get dates on those places because they're extremely popular. But if you want to get the feel of living in a Wright place in Wisconsin, there is that. And then there's music, because Wright loved music. And so there's the Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society doing Sunday concerts into the summer
at
Hillside. Yes, mm-hmm. At Hillside. And there are Friday music hells at the Unitarian Meeting House. And I have to tell you, one that I'm going to that is out of area, but there is going to be a revival of Shining Brow, which we heard a little snippet from earlier, Darren Hagen's opera. There's going to be a revival performance on the terraces at Falling Water on Wright's birthday this year.
The beautiful house building
built actually to the side of a waterfall, but it looks like it's over the waterfall in Bear Run, Pennsylvania. And that the composer will be there, and I have never seen Falling Water, and I've never seen the opera, so this is going to be quite an evening.
Well, thanks for running through an hour with us. I know not quite enough to cover the life and all of the influence and works of Frank Lloyd Wright, but Ron McCrae, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.